You're listening to the Thank God for Nostra podcast.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Thank God for Nostra podcast. My name is John, also known as Hoddlebot. I do a couple of Nostra clients, as you probably know. I have with me today Alistair Roberts. This is his second time on the podcast, my first time chatting with him. So, Alistair, thank you for joining.
Thank you for the invitation. It's good to be back.
I'm looking forward to talking to you firsthand instead of secondhand. So I figured we'd kind of pick up where we left off last time. I mean, it's been a year since the last episode. You and Jordan had a great conversation. But one thread that I thought was really, I think it's very interesting. We've been studying Understanding Media by Marshall McLuhan over the last couple months. And that's something that you really demonstrated a very thorough understanding of. And it's still something that I'm trying to wrap my head around. So to get started, why don't we talk a little bit about how exactly it is that our tools shape us, especially in terms of social media. Could you kind of like lay out a quick landscape for what social media is doing to us and why that's a problem and what it's kind of doing to society and to individuals?
Yes, big questions. I think the first thing to bear in mind is that we talk about social media. There are several different media. We're not dealing with just one sort of thing. TikTok will have different effects from Twitter or X or something like Facebook, and they tend to attract different audiences. There's a certain type of person who's on Instagram, another sort of person who tends to use Discord, whatever it is. And so it's helpful to think about each one of these media separately and to think about them also severally, how they have the different effects that they have upon us. I think one of the first things to bear in mind is the different ways in which they collapse things that would formerly have been differentiated. Now, we can talk about differentiation from various perspectives. One helpful approach, I think, is the way that someone like René Girard treats the loss of differentiation in the society and the way it leads to a sort of rivalry and antagonism and tension that needs to be diffused in various ways. Now, one of the ways that we keep ourselves differentiated and give ourselves space to respond to people rather than just react is by giving ourselves time. We have the ability to hear something and then process it and then deliberate and then respond. And one of the things that social media does, I think, is collapse time. It makes it very easy to respond instantaneously and almost just reactively. It's a sort of instinctive response rather than a considered one. And we can think about other ways it collapses things. It collapses the difference between contexts. Previously, you'd have a lot of different contexts within which certain conversations were taking place. You'd have a difference very clearly between public and private. You'd have differences between a more intimate conversation between friends and then a conversation where you're out on the street and talking to a crowd. And social media makes it very difficult to distinguish between those things. It's possible that anything that you say on something like X or Twitter could be blown up and spread to the masses. There's also the way in which it tends to collapse contexts into each other. So if you are on someone like Twitter, it's very difficult to tell what sort of background someone's coming from. You have people from all different sorts of nations. You have people from different languages, people with different ages, people who have different sort of difficulties, physical disabilities, for instance. You have people from different educational backgrounds, and they're all collapsed into the same space, talking together, and it's very difficult to get a read upon who someone is and why they're coming at a conversation from a particular perspective. It may just be that they're seeing something that we're not. And so one of the effects then, broadly speaking, of social media is to undermine the sort of differentiation that typically existed within society, the sort of differentiation that was involved in just being at a physical distance from other people and not being able to talk to everyone at once. It's a sort of mass, instantaneous media. Instantaneous, it collapses time. Mass, it collapses people from many different contexts into one, far more so than previous mass media. And it is something that also, because of its instantaneous character, tends to undermine the sort of emotional space that we need to process things in ways that give us processing time, that enable us to avoid the sort of knee-jerk reaction, hair-trigger responses to things. And so that is one of the effects of social media. I think there are many others, but that might be a good place to start.
Yeah, it is. It reminds me of how Nicholas Carr describes it in his recent book, A More Perfect Liquefaction, the removal of context, the removal of distinctions. I think an interesting direction to go would be to ask the converse question, are there distinctions that social media creates that are either salutary or artificial?
Yes, it's a good question. I think it definitely creates new distinctions. I think one of the distinctions, which I don't think is necessarily a good one, is the way in which in previous forms of society, it tends to privilege those who have lengthy experience of a given way of life. And so it tends to be the elderly have wisdom accumulated from a lot of time living in a particular environment they can pass on to others, and they can there's a sense of an intergenerational movement of insight into a particular environment. Whereas on social media, it tends to be the preserve of the young, and the young are the early adopters, and they tend to be able to, they tend to have a lot more streetwise knowledge of the media than the elderly do. And they often are the ones who are leading the way and instructing others. So that's a sort of difference created by social media and new media more generally. There are a lot of ways in which, I mean, I see this with my parents, it's difficult to get around increasingly in modern society without being technologically literate, without having an internet-connected device, without being able to function with a device if you are limited in your mobility, if you're limited in your eyesight. All these sorts of things prevent someone from accessing things that previously would have been accessible to them. Other distinctions, I think, are there are different sorts of media that privilege different sorts of skills and persons. So I think one of the benefits of the earlier internet was the way it privileged a certain type of person who was more creative, who wrote and had to create their own website, had to create their own platforms, had to basically put themselves out there. Whereas new media, I think, are a lot more democratic in that regard. And so what you tend to have, I think, is a lowering of the level of conversation than you would have when the people who are really leading the conversation are the people who are a bit more creative, a bit more ready to take the initiative, and a bit more prepared to write at length. And you'd always have the trolls, you'd always have the same issues as you have today, but it would be a different sort of dynamic. I found a number of ways that new media have allowed for certain things to take place that never would have been able to occur before. One of the great gains of social media, I think, is something like podcasting. And as we're doing now, there's no way that this conversation would have been able to occur without considerable expenditure, inconvenience, time, all these sorts of things. But because of social media and the internet, we're able to have this sort of thing. And that creates its own sort of ecology of conversation. And it creates, I think, other differences that arise from that. There are ways in which people who are able to be in regular podcast conversation with each other are able to create ecologies of conversation that are far more expansive than many of the ones that existed in the past, even in realms of specific academic conversation. You'd often find that people would feel starved of stimulating conversation to a degree that people who are regularly podcasting are not now. And so I think there are benefits in that regard. And there are differences that open up with that new realm that's created.
Yeah, I think the medium of podcasting is an interesting medium because it sits somewhere between long form thought and really short form. It also takes advantage of some of the stimulating aspects of the lower forms of social media, but also forces the participants to articulate their points more thoroughly. I definitely think it has its downfalls. The main one being that podcasting often takes the form of simulating learning. So it's, you know, it appeals to smart people who want to learn something or follow a long story or something like that, but they end up not absorbing all of the information or really engaging with it necessarily because they're multitasking while they listen to the podcast because it's very conducive to that sort of thing. So it's often more beneficial to the podcasters speaking as one currently than the listeners. So that concept of ecologies is really interesting. You know, that's sort of borrowed from Marshall McLuhan. He talks about media ecologies. And for him, it was kind of oriented around a particular medium and what it does to people. And it seems like you're talking about that a little bit, but also in terms of who are involved in these conversations, connecting people. You know, I have a friend who's an expert in cerebrospinal fluid like dynamics. And he's one of six people in the world who know what he knows about the spinal column. And he lives out in the middle of nowhere. And there are no other experts in nearby that he can interact with, but he can interact remotely, which is super, super beneficial for people trying to work together to advance a certain field of knowledge. What are your thoughts about ecology, both in terms of these social circles, but also the ecology that the medium creates?
Yeah, so we can maybe expand and play with that metaphor in various ways. One of the ways I've considered it is the sort of way that you might have a collapsing of environments into each other. So if, for instance, you created a land bridge between two isolated islands, the sort of species that would be able to thrive separate from each other are suddenly placed into antagonism, and maybe one is in danger of extinction. There's an unsettling of the ecosystem. And I think one of the things that the internet has done has collapsed many of the different niches of life into a far more unified space. And as a result, it's tended to encourage a sort of herding effect because there's no shelter, there's nowhere to really secure a little niche and form a form of life there that is not really under constant surveillance of other people. And so the tendency is to herd together and to almost move as a herd, the same sort of trigger stampede instinct that you'd find in a herd tends to play out in the social herd in social media. And feelings and passions tend to flow very naturally through that sort of setting. I think one aspect of the ecology metaphor would be thinking about the ways that in the past there were a lot more differentiations within the sort of realms we're operating. I would go into my room and I'd have the door shut and I'd maybe have music playing in the background that wasn't too distracting, and I'd read for a few hours and I would not be connected to anyone else. I was very much in a sheltered, separate location. And then I'd go out for a coffee with someone, have a conversation. And then I'd be in a classroom, I'd be learning with other people, I'd be in some sort of seminar setting and have a conversation. All of these are different realms. The more that the internet tends to intrude upon these, the more those differentiations tend to get lost. And this sort of engagement that occurs when I'm just by myself with a book tends to get shaped by the sorts of conversations and interests and concerns that are driven by a constant conversation that's always immediate, and I feel that I need to keep up with that. And so increasingly, I'm spending time on my device rather than actually just privately reading a book without any sense of this larger world of conversation. And so I think that sort of ecology, what we have is an increased flattened ecosystem without the sort of diversity within the sorts of realms we'd be operating. And so I think there are many ways we could play with that analogy of an ecosystem or ecologies.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. The freedom of associating with just yourself or to choose not to associate is an important part of that freedom. You know, people like Sheryl Sandberg want to increase the number of connections between people as much as possible because connections are good, but they're not an unmitigated good. And if you're not spending time by yourself contemplating or doing deep study, then you don't actually form memories of the foundation of wisdom. And so, yeah, I definitely agree with that. We should be separating ourselves as well as joining ourselves up with other people. One distinction that comes to mind, you know, when we're enumerating these different dimensions is the distinction of platforms. So, you know, you mentioned how different media affect the conversation, but there's also very similar media that are spread across different platforms, you know, say Twitter or Facebook, where these conversations are had and they can't interact with each other, even if the same people are there using a very similar medium. You know, and then moving into kind of the decentralized social media space, we're able to collapse that particular distinction. We collapse all the other things that legacy new media does. But that in particular is one thing that we've been looking to undermine, you know, primarily from the perspective of censorship. But, you know, if we're able to remove the differences between these platforms, do you see that as salutary or as a problem? Like, you know, platform capturing content that can become very predatory, but, you know, and then I guess just to hint at something that I've been thinking about further, how can individuals or users of the medium establish their own distinctions that actually serve their interests? So, you know, private groups, that kind of thing.
Yes, it's a good question. I think there's always a degree to which you can curate your own spaces on these various platforms. But the platforms tend to privilege certain sorts of engagement. They tend to push people in certain directions. And it's very difficult when you're pushing against those tendencies to resist them. It's one of these dynamics where I can resist perhaps some of these things over a period of time and some other people can. But yet the more general tendency will be in one direction because that's the way that a particular platform is pushing you. And so I think there's always that degree of choice that we have when we're adopting a particular platform or technology to shape the way that it's used. We don't have to just throw in our lot completely with it. We can say, we're going to use it here. We're not going to use it here. We're going to stop using it. For instance, I'm not going to use social media on Sunday. I'm going to restrict my social media uses to certain times. I'm going to restrict certain types of activity. I'm not going to engage in these sorts of conversations, whatever it is. You can place all those limits upon yourself, but the more that you have an unlimited conversation that tends to privilege certain forms of engagement over others, you have the fear of missing out. Other things are happening in your absence, and it's very difficult to not participate when that's the situation. I think various media are careful to create an ecosystem that serves their interests. Some of those will be very positive interests. They're trying to create a sort of realm of conversation that's conducive to the good, that's conducive to people thinking about things, talking about things well in a way that tends to discourage mere trolling, but also tends to encourage a degree of engagement with other people rather than just monologuing at people. And so you have these concerns on the side of those who are crafting these platforms and also on the side of those who are using them. Sadly, the people who are using them tend to just go along with the platform designs. And those who are designing the platforms, too often, I think, you mentioned Sheryl Sheryl Sandberg, tend to prioritize just maximizing possibility. But maximized possibility is not the best. And often the best platforms are ones that have all sorts of differentiated contexts. You might think about platforms in terms of things like the university. The university is a sort of context that has been carefully crafted over many years, and it has a lot of different conversations that occur within it. And there's concern to maintain all those different sorts of conversations so that one does not override all others. There's a concern, for instance, if you're going to do science, you need to have the sort of work that goes into collaborative designing of experiments. You need some sort of agonistic testing of other people's theories. You need debate. You need all these sorts of things to make science happen. And often what we have is a flattening out of conversation where the different sorts of things that a healthy platform or, and this is another possibility, a cluster of different platforms that are well coordinated, that is something that we need. And there needs to be a lot of thought increasingly on the part of the individual and how to do that. And I just don't think most people have given much thought to the matter, nor are literate enough in the media to consider the impact of which choice of the choices they make the wrong choice, and increasingly the media will shape you in ways that will just not be conducive to careful thought, to charitable conversation, to healthy society, and to even forming a healthy identity, because increasingly social media is a realm in which it's engaging with ourselves. We're creating a representation of ourselves and relating to ourselves through that. And so I admire those who are really thinking about how can we create media that are conducive to healthy selves, healthy communities, healthy interactions, and just a more healthy ecosystem, which is clearly lacking in most of the places that we look.
Yeah, and ironically, as Anton Barbicane points out, the maximization of opportunities and possibilities results in a failure to commit to any one of them, and so you end up with less activity or less meaningful activity. Pushing into this idea of crafting platforms, you know, one that comes to mind that's well crafted is Stack Overflow. They've been around for 15, 20 years. Really good question answer thing with karma and upvotes, downvotes, comments versus answers, all that kind of stuff. And they've done a really good job with that. To what extent, I guess, is my question, should we be trusting users to direct the experience? You know, you've alluded to some of to the fact that users don't necessarily understand these things about the platforms, and they are often herded into particular ways of thinking. In the Nostr space, we have this strong ethos of trusting users, because like a core part of escaping predatory platforms is called user choice. A credible exit. The user's ability to choose a alternative platform to interact with the same people in the same conversation. And that's supported through some cryptography, through some self-hosting of servers, and through multiple developers who are competing to create different options for accessing the same underlying social substrate. I think a poor understanding in myself and in the decentralized software space in general of what the role of institutions is. How far can we take sort of the anarchic approach of, if we build the tools that users can use to support their own freedom and responsibility, at what point does that fail?
Yes, it's a very good question. And I think there's always going to be some degree of tension between the interests of the various parties involved in crafting these platforms. You might think about the degree to which the many modern platforms are shaped by the interests of those who want to harvest data from their users, or the interests of those who want advertising revenue, who want to maximize hits and those things are not necessarily conducive to a healthy platform. It tends to encourage design for addiction, designed to ensure that you keep people's eyes on things, that you feed them things that will spark reaction. And often that will just be material that pushes them in a direction towards anger, towards frustration, and or towards the sorts of interactions with other people that are just counterproductive for a healthy society. And so there is clearly a problem with just leaving things in the hands of those who are designing these platforms. The people who are the creators of the technology are not always the ones to trust. And so I think a sense of the need for a platform to secure the good of the user has to be central. There really has to be an understanding of also a sense that this is a commons. This is a realm in which people are forming a community together. They are placing information that is of value to them within this realm, and they're entrusting it, and they want to have something that is trustworthy for that reason. Beyond that, I think there's, for me, I do not trust first adopters. They tend to be the people who are the most enthusiastic and the least critical and the least questioning of the dynamics of a particular platform. And that those dynamics are seldom designed. It's not as if all these things are designed. A lot of the time, it's a recognition that human nature operates in strange ways under certain dynamics and under certain environmental conditions. We do not know, for the most part, how we are supposed to function within a realm where we're constantly interacting potentially with millions upon millions of people. That's not how we're used to function. And so we tend to impose, I suppose, pictures and habits of engagement that we've gained from elsewhere. And or we engage in ways that are just completely out of touch with reality. There are ways in which, for instance, we can engage with too much intimacy. We can feel that we're deeply connected to people we've only just met online, because there's not a sense of the bodily alterity, the otherness of that person that we'd experience if we met them in person. On the other hand, we can engage with people in the most brutal and callous ways, in ways that are just antagonistic and belligerent, because again, we do not have a full sense of their otherness. And so there's always going to be a challenge to master our own nature, which is in many ways, we have these unruly passions, we have these social tendencies that are not positive. And the more that these get out of control and disordered, the more that we get addicted, the more that we get in a situation where the medium is controlling us rather than us using the medium in a way that enhances and empowers us. We fall under the control of it. And so I think in that sort of situation, you do need users to be involved in shaping it, because they're creating a realm in which they're going to hopefully master their own nature and use the medium in a way that empowers them to communicate in a way that's good and that tends towards, that is conducive for healthy interactions and healthy community and healthy identity. Now that, I think, requires a certain literacy and alertness on the part of those who are crafting the medium. And generally, to be the sort of people who are concerned to use this, but have a very clear sense of what it should be used for and how to craft things in a way that is most effective for those ends and also discourages it from being used in ways that move away from that. And so there will always have to be a degree of, I think this is important, is there always has to be a degree of user freedom that you can use these things in different ways. It's not as if there's one set use that you're forced into. Yet at the same time, there needs to be some tether upon the ultimate or the unlimited possibilities that these things can afford us. And so my belief is that what ideally you need are some users who are highly technologically literate, who have thought a lot about media ecology and things like that, and who are concerned to secure those things that are the goods of society within this new platform. And so it isn't just the people who are designing it, but nor is it just a naive user. It's someone who's a very thoughtful, experienced user who is not just going to throw themselves into every new technology or platform.
Yeah, absolutely. In a complex system like this, there are feedback loops that are hard to anticipate. And so you need a mechanism that's built in for self-correction. And that mechanism can only be human agency. And so what you're talking about as far as empowering people to who do understand what's going on to put back in and self-correct, I always think about this in comparison to how God made the world. You know, he gave us freedom. He gave us freedom because he wanted us to reciprocate his love, his free love. And so we have this world now that's fallen. And as a result, our freedom has all these terrible consequences. And yet he hasn't taken away our freedom. He has asked us to freely believe in the one who's redeeming the world. And I think patterning platforms or protocols after that kind of creation ethos is the only way to make it really work, because any non-complex system is going to fail when you introduce users into it. And so, like, the importance of an open system or open source software is huge. And there's some reason to be encouraged about the ability of users to influence the direction that these systems are going if they're open. So, like, Nostr is an open system. You can run your own stuff. You can write your own software. And with AIs, vibe coding is becoming more of a thing, where people who are not literate in a highly technical area of software development can actually express their wishes and their designs and their own interests. And so you end up with a proliferation of software, as well as the people who are behind it and who are, both people who are creating it and using their own thing. You see this with Linux. There's hundreds of distros out there for particular purposes. And what's nice is it reduces the scale at which success, the threshold for success, where if you're making your own software to scratch your own itch, all you need to do is use it, and that's success. So I find that encouraging. Another tool is cryptography. So, we have digital signatures on Nostr, which allows you to send your speech to different servers that you don't run, you don't necessarily trust, and through the redundancy, the things that you say can be self-authenticated. That's very much like a broadcast sort of metaphor, but cryptography can also create, in combination with self-hosting, can create spaces that abide by your rules and your boundaries that you set. Do you share the optimism for these tools, or is that something you thought much about?
Optimism is probably not the word I'd use, but I do believe that they have great potential and great possibilities. And I don't instantly approach them with pessimism. I think optimism might suggest, at least to me, that these things will be positive almost automatically. And my sense is more that there are great possibilities if we steward them well. And we don't need to approach with a sense of the Luddite or someone who's just skeptical about anything that's new. There are huge ways in which things can be opened up by a new form of platform. And so we should lean into these things, but do so in a way that's very circumspect. And not circumspect just to resist, but circumspect because these things, any healthy context — this has always been the case — any healthy context takes a lot of curating and careful handling. Things like that don't just happen. And so it's optimism wouldn't be the word, but I think there are great possibilities if we can steward them well. On that front, I think there's always a challenge with new technologies that what formerly was often provided by custom is now caught between the two poles of either law that has to be established with the very basic structure and controls from top down, or from wisdom, the individual setting their own terms, and they have to really know things well to be able to set the best terms. In the past, you had a lot more custom, just general expectations of people within a particular context or society, and it didn't have quite the force of law. You wouldn't go to prison if you broke custom, but there was a sense of social expectation, and there could be consequences if you broke those social expectations. And so I think that is part of the struggle. Is there a way in which, within these new contexts and platforms, that we can bring something of the reality of custom back into play, where there's a sort of healthy gravity of a particular context that encourages people to behave in a way that recognizes that this is a particular place that's been formed, a particular way of life that people are sharing, a particular realm of conversation, and it survives because people have a common code of etiquette and conduct. There's a sense of respect for each other. There's a sense of common ownership and investment, and everyone has a sense of ownership in each other, that they care about each other. And if someone disappears, they'll care about them and find out where they've gone. But that sort of society, I think that's one of the challenges that we face. Are there ways that custom can be introduced into society where increasingly you just have law or wisdom?
Yeah, and that's a very tall order. It is one reason why I'm excited about these tools, because they have the possibility, like you say, and I agree, possibility is a much better term than optimism, of creating these spaces that are supported by self-hosting or encryption, but that won't automatically result in these social norms being established. I think this is something that is overlooked, because our ability to establish social norms is actually atrophied. You know, we have these platforms that all look the same. It's still got the Facebook color on it and the rounded buttons and all this stuff. And that leads us to think that every community is the same. And really, every community is, Marshall McLuhan says, it's its own medium. It's a whole separate medium, not just content. And so going from place to place and acting exactly the same way is not actually coherent. And so I'm curious. And this is just not even a question for you. I'm just generally curious whether, swappable database backends or encrypted spaces can matter if the design isn't differentiated between different groups. Like a particular accent color might make sense in one context versus another, and, you know, many much more sophisticated toggles and designs. And another place that I think is not well understood or not emphasized is the role of community organizers. So, you know, we're all technologists building our cool tools and we think it's neat, but there are always the social layer is the base layer from which all of this stuff has to be settled at some point. You know, for the listeners, if you think of it in terms of Bitcoin, we have these second layer transactional sort of things like Lightning and eCash and stuff, but they all have to be settled to the base layer of Bitcoin at some point, which is then in turn settled to the base layer of energy input. And that's why proof of work is so important. And in a social context, the equivalent to proof of work is people talking to people and making decisions about moderation or boundaries or what to broadcast and all that kind of stuff. Could you maybe talk a little bit about what the role of leadership and authority would be in these digital spaces?
Well, it might be worth just talking about what we're doing now. There is a certain context and culture that you've established over time in a podcast. You've got a particular way of encouraging conversation. You've got a particular audience that you've formed around you. And that's one of the benefits, I think, of podcasting, that it is a context within which you can form a sort of mini culture that is shared with the listeners and is preserved over a period of many episodes. And each episode is a sort of cumulative thing. And particularly if you have several people in conversation over a long period of time, you have a sort of rapport that has really started to have a strong shape to it. And so when people come on, they have a sense of what to expect. When people listen, they know who you are. And that's the sort of thing that I don't think depends too much upon the sort of platform that you're using to record, the sort of platform that is hosting the recordings when they're uploaded. So it depends. I think there are certain platforms where there's certain types of interaction that will be a lot more dependent upon the platform. And I think that will tend to be more platforms that encourage certain sorts of conversation. Sometimes it will be the length that is encouraged or not. Sometimes it will be the speed that it encourages conversation. Sometimes it will be the degree to which it's open or a more curated, moderated community. All these sorts of factors will make a difference. But a lot depends upon the particular type of culture that you're forming. And so I think you can move from something like a podcast format where the same basic platform can sustain a myriad different sorts of cultures to a sort of mass, a mass social media medium like Twitter or X, which tends to have a more monolithic culture. It's very hard to have a very defined culture within that. So I think there's a variety. There will be some that are fairly neutral, maybe not entirely neutral, but there's a lot of latitude to form different cultures within certain platforms. Others tend to force you into one particular mode. It's one of the reasons why the split between the liberals on Blue Sky and the people on the right on X, that sort of dynamic, neither tend to function well together. And it just creates a very monolithic society in both contexts. It seems to me that that sort of platform, it's very difficult to have niches within it. Whereas others, Discord, for instance, or Reddit, even to some extent, and others, there are more possibilities. But it depends on the particular sort of community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's of course the challenge always in this conversation is we're talking about differentiation, but it's hard to differentiate between these different media and what we're actually talking about, and what we're building. So what I always end up going to is, well, what would it look like to introduce social media to my church, or to change the habits that the people at my church use in the ways in which they interact with social media. It's very common to use Facebook to organize classifieds, just Facebook Marketplace, and to a lesser extent events. But not enough people use Facebook anymore. So we're pretty much stuck with email nowadays, which is pretty amazing that protocol could have the sort of longevity that it has, to where people rely on it so strongly. I'd like to see, what are your thoughts about introducing social media to a church context for the sake of, organizing events and logistics and stuff like that, but also for cultivating conversations? Because, my sense is, to the extent that conversations happen online, if you have a physical locus, it actually tends to erode that locus as the nexus of meaning within that community.
Yes, it's a big challenge. And I think for many people, it really was something that was seen over COVID, that people suddenly had to arrange settings online when they couldn't meet in person. And for many churches, that was a big struggle. And it also, I think for some churches, has left this lingering effect where some people opt out of in-person meeting and just focus on connecting online. It's challenging. I think in some settings, this is certainly the case for my parents. My parents are not able to make it to church most weeks. My dad has advanced Parkinson's, and so he's physically not able to make it. But he's able to listen online and to join in to some extent. And that means an awful lot to him. But there are others, I think, who take that as an easy way out, to avoid actually having to come in and attend a meeting with physically. I think my experience in when things were first being set up for virtual interaction for my church, there were, I'm thinking, for instance, one person trying to teach this person how to use a mouse. She never learned how to use a mouse before. She was in her 70s. It just was completely foreign to her. And for many people in an older church, which my church is, they just will be squeezed out by new technology. They just don't know how to navigate it. And so getting them to, I tried to get some people in my church to adopt Discord, that was a step too far. What has worked to some extent is groups like WhatsApp or Telegram. They work to some extent because many of them will have them for their grandchildren. But it's a challenge because there's always going to be a barrier to those who are the elderly within a congregation. And it tends to privilege the youth who are able to have several different sorts of platforms, be active on several platforms at once. So that's one of the challenges I've experienced. But I found the greatest benefits of these sorts of media to be the connections between churches, not necessarily within a given church. It can be helpful there, but the greatest strengths tend to be in strengthening the relationships between people within an area or within a larger theological conversation, whatever it is. It's those sorts of things that I think are often the most effective.
Yeah, interesting. So a shared community identity that isn't well facilitated by physical contact or by the existing broadcast media that are out there, but where somewhere where you want to have that sort of private space or curated conversation. That's an interesting alternative.
One thing I've found is that the ideal is to focus. The ideal is actually to be together in person. That is always going to be the best thing. And there's no substitute for that. But some people cannot do that for a reason of illness or something else or distance. That will be a struggle for some people. And so it can be a good supplement or substitute for some people. What I've found for the wider context is it can be an initial source of contact from which in-person contact can arise. It can be a great context to organize movements. And if you've struggled to get people interested in, say, people within the UK do not have large settings of theological conversation in their area. What they can have are connections with people who have theological interests elsewhere in the country. And then having that sort of background conversation that's going on over a longer period of time, whenever you're in the same area as other people, you meet up and you arrange events and there's psalm roars and things like that that people arrange. And so out of this network of connection arises in-person contact. And so I've found, I've probably met over 500 people I first met online or first got in contact with online in person. And so the internet connection is often the first step towards in-person connections and communities. And then that feeds back. There's a sense in which once you've met people in person, you have a rapport and trust that is kind of different from the sort of thing that you develop merely online. You know what sort of person they are. You can read their tone a bit better. You can interact with them with a bit more familiarity. And then from that point onwards, there's a strengthening of the online interaction. And so I've always seen it as it's like the illustration I've often given is it's like scaffolding. You don't want to live in the scaffolding all the time, but the scaffolding enables you to build spectacular structures that would not be possible otherwise.
My earbuds ran out of batteries. I totally agree with that. That seems to be the natural trajectory of online events or communities often want to get in touch with each other in person. And that in-person conversation also has a way of being a corrective for the digital space, where if something's starting to go off the rails because people are seeing each other as abstractions, when you see someone in person, that can be largely solved. Nicholas Carr talks about that as in his recent book Superbloom, how we see other people as abstractions. And you know, the logic of a lot of these online platforms is that the more we connect with each other, the better things will be. But it turns out there's this like dissimilarity cascade thing where people actually start to dislike each other the more they know about each other. And that's true in person and in the digital spaces, but it's in digital spaces, there's less of a feedback loop to actually be a real person and to invoke empathy and that sort of thing.
One thing I've found as a discipline is just going to a context where you're worshiping with Christians in your area within walking distance who are rather different from you and force you to learn how to be with people who don't just share all your interests, who don't have the same sorts of conversations as you might have. And that sort of interaction, I think, is a great corrective against chosen community that you can easily have online, a sort of community that allows you to play to all of your instincts, all of your preferences. And so having those two things alongside each other, one can be a corrective to the extremes of the other. And the online communities I've found have been great to enable me to lean into certain of my interests. And yet that's always been something I've needed to keep in check by actual in-person contact with people who are different from me in a local setting and learning to just be grounded by those sorts of relationships where it's not just meeting with people with the same areas of interest, the same age as I am, the same sort of educational background, social context. There's a concern, I think, to avoid the sorting mechanism that the internet can accentuate. And that sort of dynamic, I think, is a very important one for Christians, because it is very easy to form communities that are merely with the sorts of people that we get on with. And part of the discipline of the Christian life is learning to forgive and learning to love and recognize others. And that is best practiced in a context where you don't just choose your own community. There's a certain degree in which it's given and you just have to live with it. And you have to be faithful wherever you find yourself.
Yeah, it can be surprising and also refreshing how idioms change and conversations change when you just interact with, your neighbors, people at a different church that you don't go to that's local, or, you know, if you join, a workout group or a group that plays games or something like that. The variability of human experience and dynamics between people is insanely varied, and it's fun too to go outside of your comfortable circles.
The other thing I found is that a lot of the craziness of the modern world is a result of people being able to sort into a niche group that has all of their extreme problems and none of the correctives that you'd have just within the general group of people. And so some of the really weird things that we see within society today, I think, are accentuated by the sorting mechanism the internet allows for. The internet is the city 2.0 in many ways. The city was the place where if you were a weirdo and you wanted to connect with other weirdos, you could move to the city. There'd always be some small group of weirdos there, and you could share your own weird interest. But the internet is that blown up 1,000 or more times. And so there's always some niche group that will be messed up in exactly the way that maybe you are messed up. And that is a challenge that I think we need to be aware of. And so having that tether to an actual real life community that's formed of many different types of people is a good grounding mechanism to prevent the sorting mechanism of the internet, to prevent it from going off the rails. Both of those things can be good, provided that there are checks.
Yeah, the sorting mechanism is another example of that unity diversity problem, where in our attempt to differentiate ourselves from everyone else and also to get in touch with everyone in the whole world, we end up with this monoculture somehow. It's ironic, it's strange, it kind of happens on its own, or at least as a result of people's preferences. Switching gears a little bit. So one question I often ask my guests is, what kind of vision do you have for the future? And for you, I'd like to amplify that a little bit and ask, what to you is a compelling theology of technology? You know, Theopolis has the Theopolitan vision, and maybe you could describe that a little bit. What should we be expecting and hoping for from technology? And how should we be approaching it as Christians? You know, in your previous interview, I appreciated that you just came right out at the very beginning and said, social media, we just can't throw it away. We can't throw it away. And you didn't have sort of this fatalistic response to that as like, well, I guess we lost. It's like, no. We are winning. We just have to figure out how to win in this new way that's been presented to us.
Yes, the Theopolitan vision is probably best expressed in the tagline of Theopolis, Bible, Liturgy, and Culture. There's a centrality to the Word of God. It's authoritative. It gives us orientation within the world. And there's a sense in which this is the reality at the heart of all of it. It exposes the reality at the very heart of life and exposes the human heart. And then out of that, there is this, the expression of that is liturgy. Liturgy is worship. Liturgy is the fundamental practice of the church, the context within which the Bible is most primarily engaged. It's the context where we address ourselves to God. It's the place where we get perspective on everything else. And from that flow all these other things. And so culture is downstream of worship. We can think about the way that worship is a context that has a sort of, it's like a game. A game is a context that's connected with regular life, but it's also set apart. There's a sense in which it's operating on a different register. There's a dynamic to it that's different from our regular life, and yet it plays into regular life. And so when we're engaged in worship, there's a sense in which we're engaged in a sort of play that's distinct from the regular quotidian dynamics of society and forces us to reconsider the way that we engage with things, to have a vision for how things really ought to be, to have a sense of who we are, who God is, what the world is, and our place within it. And so that is the fundamental thing, get orientation. And I think the vision for us with regard to technology is we want to have orientation so that technology is something that we are using to extend our rule and our dominion in creation, the way in which we're bringing glory to God through it, the way in which we're forming ourselves in faithfulness, all of these sorts of things. Now, technology holds great potential for all of those things. It enables us to extend our reach, the ability to communicate. We can think about the degree to which the church's message has often used new technologies because of the different, the huge potential that they afford. Think about the early church and its use of the codex, or the way in which the Reformation was really, is really spread in large part with the printing press, or the way in which the modern world or the missionary movement, things like travel opening up, or the degree to which the steam printing press changed things. And now we have new possibilities with the internet that enables us to spread God's word, that enables us to engage with God's word and thought in different ways. We can think even about discussed a podcast like this. One of the things that I do with Theopolis is the weekly podcast, which is going through some biblical book. And so at the moment, we're going through the book of Hebrews. We've just finished a series on Deuteronomy. And there are four of us who, over a long period of time, are getting into depth in each one of the chapters. And the series on Deuteronomy was 71 episodes long. It really in-depth treatment of this book that is just so rich, and each episode about an hour in length. Now, that would not be possible were it not for social media. And so this is a technology that has afforded a great new possibility, that's extended biblical study and thoughts and engagement with the most fundamental thing of all, the scripture. And so scripture is then something that has a greater part in our lives. You can think about one of my great projects over the last few years has been doing a chapter by chapter commentary on the whole Bible in audio format. And again, it's made possible by the internet. The funding model is entirely supported by donations. It's something that is freely available for anyone, anywhere. It's something that's being transcribed. Again, new technologies making this possible, and things that would not be affordable in the past, now they're possible because of the internet and AI and other things like that. Now, that is, again, engaging with the fundamental thing of scripture and then working out from that. In the wider task of shaping culture, I think my sense is that with each new technology, it's a sort of principle or law or logic that's set loose in the world. And these things, because we're living our lives in terms of them, they can be like new gods that we start to order our lives around. And so ideally what we want is to have things oriented by the worship of the true God and by the context of liturgy that orients us to reality, orients us to who we are. And then downstream of that, technology is mastered as something that is a good thing in God's world. It's an extension of our capacities. Can think about the most basic tools are the ones that extend human capacities and develop human beings along with them. If you learn how to use a skill, a technology or tool well, you become skillful. It's an extension of you as a person. The person who's a skilled musician, that musical instrument isn't an extension of their body. You can think about many instruments are an extension of our command of our breath. And then that instrument becomes this way in which that person can act within the world with greater skill, with greater impact. Ideally, that's what we want for our new technologies. The challenge is that they are increasingly totalizing. They create not just something that we're acting into an existing realm, they are whole realms in themselves. And so we're like fish within this new sort of water, and we're trying to negotiate what is this water and trying to understand how it is that we're going to craft the environments that we operate within, and recognizing that in the process, we're also crafting those things that will shape us. And so my hope is that there will be a constant return to the context of scripture in the world of worship that will orient us to technology and enable us to craft technology from a position that's not always immersed in it. And so I think one of the benefits of a healthy context of worship is it's not technology heavy. It gives us the ability to step back from technology from time to time, to reconnect with the most basic things, the human body, human community, bread and wine, washing with water, the human word spoken, and all these sorts of things. And then from that, we're able to go back into the crafting of technology and the using of technology in a way that's oriented around that central human vision, and a human vision that's oriented by who God is.
Yeah, I think you could identify any number of points throughout history where we went off the rails, but the sort of shift or maybe this is assuming too much about what came before, but the prioritization of efficiency in production and profit over people and people's good. You know, Wendell Berry touches on this a lot, and that was kind of what the Luddites were getting at when they broke the looms. The reorientation of ourselves to not just human good, but also to glorifying God. Everything comes out of that. Worship is the centerpiece because it is the cultus. It's what you organize your society around. So I think that answer is correct, helpful. Also, in a way, sort of tautological. It's like, what you orient yourself around is what you'll become. Unfortunately, we're not currently oriented around that. And I appreciate that you approach that question not only by calling out the content of what the technology is doing, but also technology as a medium itself. Do you feel like we have the tools to understand how this media is working in our lives in this kind of like new sort of dialectic where we're not just talking with each other, we're talking with our things more and more often? And, you know, I also feel like it's potentially a hopeful thing because the scripture talks about rocks crying out if we keep silent and stuff like that. And we literally have rocks that cry out at this point. We have silicon that's been trained to talk using human language. Do you see this as part of like the redemption of creation? Does technology have a role in that?
I'm not sure I necessarily speak about is the redemption of creation. I think it's part of the basic calling of humanity to exercise dominion within the creation. It's not necessarily saving it, but I think it's something that's ordering it towards its highest ends. We can think about the way that when we're engaged in the work of technology, we're bringing things into a human realm of engagement and concern, and that is a fundamental human task, and I think part of our human calling, and there's a dignity to be found in that. One thing I think is that the speed with which we do these things is important. We need time to deliberate and think about how these things are shaping us. We don't find out how a new technology is shaping us within a couple of years. It's the sort of thing that needs a proper life cycle. We need human beings learn by seasons of sowing and reaping, for instance. In our personal experience, we learn what good and bad decisions are by the fruit that are yielded from the things that we do over time. And that, I think, is one of the dangers of modern technology. It moves at such a pace that we're not able to go through that process of deliberation and reflection. We're not able to adopt things gradually. And I think this is an important thing to do, that not everything, we don't want everything to be hyper-disruptive. We want things to be able to move over and in ways that ensure that people aren't left behind, particularly the elderly and those who are disabled, whatever. We want a society that does not throw in its lot completely with every new thing that comes along. The fact that we have so many new technologies that have near universal adoption within our society within a period of about 15 years, that is somewhat concerning to me. And particularly when it comes to the shaping of the young, we don't know what the internet is, what certain forms of social media are going to do to the young in forming them until we've spent 20 years at least with those. And yet we're experimenting en masse within our society. And so I think if we're going to master technology, we will need to move at a human pace, not at the pace of technology itself. And that is a challenge when the technology is developing so rapidly and human beings are slow. We take time to process things.
How might you suggest managing that? You know, like China has Hong Kong as their kind of like, here's the place where we'll remove all the laws and you guys can do stuff with crypto and accelerate things. And then China will follow along and pull things from. I think that's an interesting model, you know, reservations about China notwithstanding. Could we do something like that where there's like these incubation sort of organizations that experiment with accelerating technology, but for the rest of society, we can slow down? You know, the worry I would have about that is that seems to require a lot of centralized control of what people are allowed to do. And human agency and freedom are important parts of a functioning society. So like, how do you reconcile those things?
Yeah, so yeah, I think when we're thinking about the control, the locus of control is an important thing to consider, because sometimes it's top-down, it's government, it's law. Other times it's custom. You can think about the way that a society, a more Mennonite, Amish society might run things in a more customary way. And so legally speaking, there may not be limits upon them, but in terms of custom, there are clear limits. So then there are also different ways in which custom can weight things. It may not be absolutely wrong for you to do something, but maybe just frowned upon or discouraged. There are things like schools' policies for kids on connected devices. That sort of thing is a sort of custom that I think is important, because it's very hard to do these things on an individual level. Because if your kid goes to a school where another kid gets a connected device, suddenly every kid in the class wants one, and it becomes, the culture has its own force, and it's very hard to resist that. And so generally, I think what we need is contexts that are able to have enough integrity to set their own patterns. And people can opt in and out of these, perhaps, but it is important that we enable people to set up their own cultures and customs that maintain those cultures. On that front, I think your example of Hong Kong is an interesting one. We can maybe think about adopting a new technology. It does not have to be all at once, everyone at once. It can be in particular contexts. We allow this technology in this particular setting. We're not going to allow this technology in schools until we've spent a lot of time with this technology and know its effects. We're not going to experiment with this on kids. And so those sorts of things might be just the way that you run things in your household. You say that you're not going to have a device until you're 14 or something like that. And at that point, there will be these sorts of controls. And then over time, you'll have a bit more latitude in what you can do. Every family, I think, will have some sort of culture or customs that they have, home rules that they're establishing to ensure that their kids are formed in as well as they can. Now, I think within a society, we need some sort of coordinated response like that. And that's the challenge, because these technologies are operating on such a vast scale, the whole human race. And do we have structures of coordination that are sufficient for that without world government? We don't want world government. We don't. And even doing these things at the level of national government, it feels like overkilling, or it feels like introducing principles of control that we've not had to that degree before. And so naturally and appropriately, I think people are nervous about that. And yet the technology, on the other hand, is introducing a law, a logic that is equally totalizing. And so what we really need, I think, is finding some ways to differentiate environments, contexts, and cultures so that things can be gradually introduced or held back from going any further than a particular point where they've been shown to be useful within those bounds and shown to be deleterious when they extend beyond them. Now, that's the big question. Do we have structures of coordination that are sufficient for that? And in the past, customs and cultures provided something of that. Now it's a much harder task. And I think many people are trying to think about how can we form communities, whether schools or churches or neighborhoods, that provides some sort of bounds upon more general world that we talk about globalization and these sorts of dynamics. But whatever it is, we are increasingly subject to a unified environment where something introduced into the marketplace or introduced into our new technologies spreads throughout everyone at once. And so the question is, what sort of boundaries can we establish that enable us to have niches of sanity and to hold things in some degree of, to have some degree of control over their spread? And I don't think we have straightforward answers to that. That doesn't mean we can't do that, we're left with nothing to do. I think there are ways churches can respond to this, help to orient people. Individual families can do a lot. Schools can set up media policies and with agreement from parents. There are things that we can do, but I don't believe that we crack this problem.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't even know what the next question is to ask in that conversation. I mean, the obvious answer would be, well, you know, do what you were alluding to earlier and get to know your neighbors, get to know local people, spend time physically with people, have conversations, teach each other the things that you know. And, you know, I think localism can go a long way towards ameliorating a lot of the chaos that these things unleash. Obviously, like you're saying, they are totalizing and they are at global scale. So there's only so much we can do in a grassroots way, but grassroots has to be a big part of the answer at any rate. I think that's a good place to set it down. I appreciate you joining. Could you really quickly kind of give a handoff if people want to learn more about your work or read what you've been working on? Listen to your 71 part series on Deuteronomy.
Yes, if you want to listen to the series on Deuteronomy, you can do so by looking up Theopolis on SoundCloud. The Theopolis website is well worth a visit. There's all sorts of articles and other things there. I have my own Substack, argosy.substack.com, and I also have a YouTube channel. If you go there, you can find playlists with the complete biblical reflections that I've done to this point. Those would be the best places to start.
Perfect. Well, thank you for coming on, and hopefully we can do this again next year.
Fantastic. Thank you for the invitation.